We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, March 19th, and that apparently means that Devin, one of our great producers, it is his birthday today. He is turning 29. No, I'm kidding. I won't actually say his age, but I learned that this morning, and so we want to wish Devin a very, very happy birthday, and you can, of course, write into the comments line or jenna@afr.net and extend your birthday wishes to Devin, who probably doesn't celebrate as much as I do, but I think it's like an entire birth month of celebration, and because my birthday happens to be on the 1st of the month of November, then I feel like I just get the entire month to celebrate. So birthdays are great. And, you know, celebrations are fun and holidays are just jolly. So I like all of that stuff. But I'm really excited this morning because we get to be really wonky about the Constitution. And this just exemplifies this case that was argued at the Supreme Court yesterday, exactly why I love constitutional philosophy and getting into some of the weeds of exactly how our system of government works and what restraints should be placed on the government and when in tension with government's limited powers and protected rights of the individual that, of course, come from God, our Creator. Of course, the individual should win out. And that was on display yesterday in the argument in Murphy versus Missouri, which was originally filed as Missouri versus Biden. So you probably have heard it on that name. And that was a case that was argued yesterday involving the First Amendment, the federal government, and social media. And so as we are navigating kind of these new waters of public forums, and the dogs are also very excited this morning to talk about this because there's apparently somebody outside. But and so they say hi. Todd and Copper say hi today. But as we're navigating these new waters of social media and public forums that are these online places of discourse, it's really fascinating to see how the law has to take the principles of our Constitution and our framework of government and apply them to new territories. And this is where our founders were so incredibly brilliant, because even though obviously, you know, the founders, Thomas Jefferson, when he was sitting around in part drafting the Declaration, wasn't contemplating having an iPhone and social media, right? But the principles that apply to all of our rights and the powers that were given to government, those haven't changed. They just are applied in recognizing how our technology is evolving and how we are facing new issues. But the principles remain the same. And so this is why originalism in the Constitution and looking at the text and understanding that the Constitution is not about just guaranteeing certain rights to citizens. Our rights don't come from the Constitution. They come from God, our Creator. The government just has very, very limited powers. And so to then do the functioning of legitimate government. And so the entire case yesterday centered around whether the Biden administration and its collusion with social media, particularly during the COVID pandemic, and of course I put that in air quotes, and their whole mandates of the vaccine and the vaccine campaigns, and when there were other doctors, including Jay Bhattacharya, who has been a guest on this program, good friend Dr. Rob McCullough, you know, some of these others that are that were prolifically pushing back against the government's narrative at the time and saying, well, wait a minute, what the government's telling us doesn't necessarily jive with the evidence that we're seeing, or maybe we're looking at some other potential remedies or some other potential ways of dealing with COVID. And that was termed misinformation and disinformation and harm to the public by the government. And the government then went, and this came out during the Twitter files when Elon Musk took over Twitter, and now it's known as X, and released all of these internal documents. And Eric Schmidt, who is now a senator but was the former attorney general of Missouri, filed a lawsuit against the Biden administration, so Missouri versus Biden, and got even more of these documents that showed clear collusion between the government and big tech and social media, and the government and agents inside the Biden administration basically telling and coercing social media and collaborating with them, colluding with them. So it wasn't even like the social media giants were pushing back and saying, well, wait a minute, free speech matters. But they were colluding with big tech to say, you need to censor these types of opinions and viewpoints on social media. And so the entire question from the court yesterday was whether the Biden administration's collusion with big tech essentially turned big tech and the social media platforms into state actors because of their collusion, and therefore then come under the purview of the First Amendment, because the First Amendment only applies to government actors. So for example, here at AFR, as an employee, I'll just use this as a hypothetical, but you know, as an employee here at AFR, if Tim decided that he didn't want me to talk about a specific topic, or, you know, when I go and actually go into the headquarters at AFR, they say, you know, you can't wear a T-shirt with some kind of language on it, whatever. They're a private organization. They can do that. Right. And that would be something where I would have the option of either complying with that or maybe going and getting a different job. Right. So it's not the government. But when the government is trying to censor speech, then there are First Amendment protections. And so the question has always been, what about public forums? And especially in this instance, when the government is colluding with big tech, does that make big tech in this instance a state actor? And now the First Amendment protections apply, because the Biden administration can't say, well, hey, you know, this isn't traceable to us because we're using a private actor independently. There's a whole body of case law about how in criminal context, for example, where the government will use confidential informants, or they will use other private citizens to go do their bidding, and they become state actors. And so all of the protections in terms of due process, in terms of, you know, substantive protections of the Constitution, including the First Amendment, always apply then to even the conduct of the agents of the state. They don't necessarily have to even be an employee. And agency legal theory is a whole other body of case law that, you know, you get into the weeds in law school, and all of it's really fun and very interesting. But for purposes of our conversation today, it's very simple. Big tech was an agent of the government. I mean, that's really clear. And to censor American speech because the government is alleging that anyone who goes against their narrative for their vaccine campaign or their public health measures, then that is misinformation, disinformation, and harmful to the American public, such that they have a special and particular interest in stopping that speech and have the power to go and censor that speech against the constitutionally protected right of individuals to post their opinions, is very clear. The government cannot do that. It can speak more, and it can say, we disagree with those opinions, please listen to us. And it can seek to persuade, but it cannot compel individuals to remain quiet. That's the whole point of the First Amendment. And that is something that Ketanji Brown Jackson just really, really did not understand yesterday. And this was the main clip that came out of this argument yesterday, that she was actually concerned that the First Amendment is making it harder to censor speech. That's like, hint, Ketanji Brown Jackson, that's literally the entire point of the First Amendment, is that it makes it harder for government to censor American speech. That's why we have the Bill of Rights. That's why we have the Constitution. But this is what she had to say. Cut three.
Concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. What would you have the government do? I've heard you say a couple times that the government can post its own speech, but in my hypothetical, kids, this is not safe, don't do it, is not going to get it done. And so I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country, and you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. So can you help me? Because I'm really worried about that, because you've got the First Amendment operating in an environment of threatening circumstances from the government's perspective, and you're saying that the government can't interact with the source of those problems.
This is wild. This is absolutely wild that you have a sitting Supreme Court justice who takes, an oath to the Constitution, who is supposed to understand just basic framework of government. The Babylon Bee, of course, said it so perfectly. Their headline is, Ketanji Brown Jackson warns right to free speech could lead people to speak freely. Yeah, that is kind of the point. And they go on to go, and the article is really funny. I mean, you should click beyond the headlines in Babylon Bee, because sometimes their actual content is so funny. And it ends, at publishing time, arguments had to be suspended to give Justice Jackson an opportunity to read a second grade history textbook about the U.S. Constitution. This is just so insane that a sitting Supreme Court justice does not understand that the point of the Constitution is to hamstring the government. The point is to say, the government, you have only specific limited powers. And notice how she is presuming in her question that there is harm and that the government won't be persuasive if they just go out and actually do their social media campaigns and they push back, and that people just won't trust the government over and above other people's speech. Well, I think that's kind of the government's problem, but that doesn't mean that the government can use its power to stop other people from speaking. So Jim Jordan had this comment to say in response. This is cut four.
The big takeaway today was Ketanji Brown Jackson, when she said to the Solicitor General from Louisiana, she said, you've got the First Amendment hamstringing the government. Well, that's what it's supposed to do, for goodness sake. It was literally one of the craziest things I've ever seen, that you could have a justice on the United States Supreme Court say that in the oral argument. It made no sense to me. That is frightening, because if she really believes that, that is scary where we're headed. Understand what took place here. This was censorship by surrogate. This was big government telling big tech to take down speech they disagreed with. And it was the most fundamental kind of speech. It was political speech, the kind that's supposed to have the most heightened scrutiny you can have before you can take that down. But that's what took place. And then to have a justice on the Supreme Court say what she said, that is frightening.
So well said. And I love how Congressman Jim Jordan just rants against some of these just ridiculous things, because this is why Americans and every citizen needs to understand how our Constitution works, so that we can pinpoint things like this and all of us rant in the same way that Representative Jim Jordan is doing. Because when you have a sitting Supreme Court justice that's suggesting that the heightened scrutiny of political speech should not apply and the First Amendment shouldn't apply here, because in the midst of one of the worst, public health crises, according to her, that the government is now hamstringed by the First Amendment in not being able to censor speech of Americans that simply are exercising political views and opinions, that is absolutely crazy. I mean, that's like the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, that is something that is so completely against the American system of government that it is genuinely absolutely scary. But remember, I mean, this is the same woman who couldn't say what a woman is. I mean, so, you know, she's just a leftist that is spouting leftist rhetoric nonsense from the bench because she clearly has more fealty to the Marxist viewpoint of the left than she does fidelity to the U.S. Constitution. And that is a very, very scary thing and why we have to keep originalists on the bench. But there's so much more to rant about this. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are ranting this morning about the U.S. Constitution, the specific limited powers that are given to government, and the rights that every human being made in the image of God has that come from God himself and are supposed to be protected by the Constitution and by our government if it's acting legitimately. And in the context of Murphy versus Missouri, which is the case argued yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court, and talking about whether the government's conduct in the midst of the COVID pandemic and the Biden administration transformed private social media companies' content moderation decisions into state action and violated the respondent's First Amendment rights. So here to rant with me, because I need a ranting partner this morning, is our very good friend and First Amendment lawyer himself, Ron Coleman, who also hosts the Coleman Nation podcast. So Ron, this is an incredibly important case for the First Amendment, for free speech rights. So give me your take.
Well, first of all, Jenna, if I would have known you wanted me to rant at 8 o'clock in the morning, I would have reconsidered this entire invitation. I can barely.
Well, this is why I didn't tell you beforehand. This is what happens when you come on early.
I'm pretty confident that this is going to go the right way, but I can't say that I love the way the questioning went. I do think it is a mistake, and you know this from your own experience, to handicap the outcome of an argument too much based on the oral argument. But there were some really troubling premises that seemed to be widely accepted across the court, including this idea that there's definitely something out there where the government should be making sure that we know the truth and that the government is the repository of truth. And the only question is, how bad does it have to be before we let the government save us from our own incompetence?
Yeah. And this is where the argument, and I agree with you, there was this presumption that really wasn't ever challenged in the argument that the government's narrative was correct and there had been harm done to the public by the opinions of these private citizens, a lot of them doctors who are the plaintiffs, pushing back against the narrative. The conversation really centered on whether the government then has the right to censor Americans and their speech when there is harm and when it does fly in the face of what the quote-unquote truth is. And of course, you know, here and especially here on AFR as a Christian audience, I mean, we believe in objective fundamental truth. It's not my truth versus your truth. But when we're talking about opinions, you can have a different opinion, and the government is not the arbiter of truth. It's not the ministry of truth. And especially when you have different considerations like the COVID pandemic and how to treat COVID, there is not one central, this is true and this is false. And so that was a little bit wild to me that whole premise was not challenged more, that the government should not be a ministry of truth. Why do you think really raised that?
I wish at one point the lawyer for the respondents had said, the government's frequently wrong.
Yeah.
And that would have just covered so many things. There was also this repeating theme, not as strong that. But listen, the government needs to be able to tell social media platforms when there's foreign influence. Really, like the entire January 6th. I'm sorry, not the entire Trump-Russia foreign influence thing that didn't exist. It's really problematic. And what look, we saw this during COVID. We saw this during the COVID cases. What we also saw yesterday was that a significant portion of the court has not bothered to acquaint itself with the facts. Sotomayor actually accused the respondents of writing a sloppy and misleading brief. And I thought it was very, very well done. How he handled it. Gosh, sorry, Your Honor, if there were any mistakes, they certainly weren't intentional. Let's talk about the issues. But it was really sleazy.
Can we sidebar really quick and just rant about Sotomayor, like just for a moment here?
She
always is so disrespectful to the side that she's clearly against, and she has these types of personal attacks. There was no reason to say that other than wanting to publicly, you know, kind of embarrass him a little bit. I feel like, and for her to just go on some of these long-winded rants that articulate her position to the rest of the court and eat up the time of the advocate who clearly is representing the side that she disagrees with, I think that's so disrespectful to the process.
She is, you know, she's definitely a problem. What can I say? It is disappointing. You know, it was interesting because our friend Randy Barnett made a very strange tweet yesterday. He said, I really thought Justice Jackson has really become a much sharper questioner.
No.
And I guess in a sense of verbal acuity, maybe she's sharper, but she said some real whoppers yesterday, including the now infamous, and it's interesting watching people trying to spin this claim that if there's one thing we don't want, it's for the government to be hamstrung. Gosh, look, one thing that I really appreciate was that at the very beginning, Justice Thomas fired a shot across the bow. I'm not sure it's going to do anything with the rest of the court about this nonsense, this government speech nonsense that has crept into First Amendment jurisprudence, which is that the government has some kind of counterbalancing weight in a First Amendment case. It's true that the government does have to communicate in order to govern. No one questions that. But government speech has been really abused by judges over the last 10 years. And Justice Thomas did achieve something, which was to get the government to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have that sound. Let's play this,
right?
Because this was actually, I agree. I highlighted this as one of the best moments right off the top that Justice Thomas made an excellent point. This is cut two.
Amendment cases.
Any First Amendment cases? I'm sorry.
Employing state action doctrine.
And suing the government. Off the top of my head, I can't think of one.
So there are usually things like Medicare or government contracts or relationships like that.
Yeah, and I think what that gets at is that it's very unusual, and we don't think it's possible for the government through speech alone to transform private speakers into state actors. We think these cases usually are and ought to be viewed through the Bantam Books type framework, where there's a problem if the government is engaged in coercion, but if it stays on the persuasion side of the line and all we're talking about is government speech, then there's no state action and there's also no First Amendment problem.
And this was actually, he goes on, and this clip was actually supposed to be literally the next thing that he said was, I have one last question for you, which is, you know, where is where in the Constitution is the right of the government to speak to protect it? I mean, where in the Constitution is that found? And of course, Brian Fletcher, the Solicitor General, arguing, says, well, nowhere in the text. I mean, he totally concedes that government doesn't have rights. Government has only limited powers to act. And Thomas just goes, you know, for my edification, just, you know, where is that in the text? And it was wonderful. So you're absolutely right.
It was important to get that in there.
Yeah. Because that's the whole point, is that, you know, all of these leftists are suggesting that, oh, poor little victimized government that is basically a person, and it needs to speak as well. And, you know, you don't need to quell our speech. Nobody's talking about that. The government has its own social media accounts. In fact, you know, the White House, the POTUS account, the press secretary, all of these are way bigger accounts than, you know, a lot of these doctors were initially. They only rose in popularity and followers on social media because of their speech pushing back against the government. Nobody is thinking, oh, poor little government.
Nobody cares but the government, but boy, does the government care. And this is all, I wish I could say no one cares but the government. The fact is, the left, and to a large extent, liberals, as they used to be called, have made trust in and reliance on the government an ideological ideological fundament in their worldview, and it really came across almost universally among the justices yesterday. The premise was, how much should we let the government do its benevolent job of protecting us?
Right. And that's so well put, is that, you know, the government needs to, it almost has a duty. I mean, that's what Ketanji Brown Jackson said, was the government, you know, has this duty to protect its citizens from all of this misinformation. And we are hamstringing, you know, the good little sheriff of Nottingham from going and taxing the poor people. I mean, this is just terrible, right? I mean, that's what she's saying. And that's literally what the First Amendment is designed to do. And so, do you think that this was in any way, Ron Coleman, convincing to a majority of the court here? Or what do we maybe expect from the outcome of this?
I expect a 6-3 opinion with probably a concurrence of some sort. That concurrence might be from the more conservative justices who want the court to have gone further than it probably will. But I do think that the View Caucus will dissent. They are completely in the hands of judges. We saw this with Sotomayor during COVID, when, you know, she kept coming back to this idea, but it's a once in history, or once in a lifetime pandemic, as if that justified, you know, abridging the First Amendment. So I don't think this is going to be another one of those per curiam opinions, but I do think that the correct side will win here because of the, notwithstanding the complete, I mean, also it was so disappointing. You know, we don't have the highest expectations for Sotomayor, but Kagan usually is more with it, and her pretense that she couldn't imagine any real harm here, couldn't see the problem, was pretty distressing.
Which is totally bizarre. And you and I spoke about this a little bit yesterday. You know, why I was very concerned that some of the harm didn't get into or wade into some of our jurisprudence on prior restraint. This whole idea and understanding that the government, or even private actors, but you can't censor speech before it's been spoken. You can't tell someone, hey, you're going to commit a harm and we're going to restrain you further. I mean, it's almost like similar to pre-crime theory. And yet, when you're suspending accounts because, oh, they have said misinformation in the past, you're not just taking down posts. And obviously, we disagree with that whole theory and characterizing it as misinformation. But even assuming that's true, saying, well, because this particular person or this account has put up misinformation in the past, we're going to suspend the account completely so that it can't spew more misinformation. That is a harm. And that really, in my view, flies in the face of all of our jurisprudence on prior restraint.
Your view is the correct view.
Well, good. I mean, this is why listeners listen to me, right? Okay. Because, yes, because I'm correct. But so why do you think, though, Ron Coleman, that we didn't get into that, or maybe will just the oral argument didn't go there, but there will be some discussion potentially in the majority opinion, assuming it's right?
I don't really know. I mean, thank God we have Justice Alito there and Justice Thomas, and I think they will remind their colleagues that the frequent refrain by Justice Jackson that, look, well, as long as there's a compelling government interest is incorrect. Compelling government interest is one of the components that you look at in any strict scrutiny analysis, and the strict scrutiny analysis has to be made in any instance of prior restraint. And it was mm-hmm. also a big mistake, and I do think that the lawyer from Missouri did what he could to deal with this, but there was a very frequent refrain of this idea that, how is this different from the government merely reaching out to someone to say, hey, a correction is needed in your editorial. Your article has something wrong in it. This is about third parties. He said this more than once. This is not about someone reaching out to the writer or the editor of the newspaper. This is about a platform being told entire groups, entire categories of persons should not be allowed to communicate to the American people. What's interesting also, Jenna, is that not at no point during the discussion yesterday was the issue of whether this is a public forum raised. And it appears that approach is dead. And I know that it wasn't really on the table here, but it's not as if Justice Thomas hasn't raised it in the past.
Yeah, that's actually a really fascinating point and something I hadn't considered, Ron Coleman, that, you know, we are wading into kind of some new territory with social media, and some of these things haven't been particularly nailed down yet. And I was speaking earlier in my initial rant before you came on and decided to rant with me, you know, that all of these principles that have been embedded in our Constitution since the founding have to be applied in new ways to new technology, and that includes the online public forum. And the fact that we're not talking about this, especially in the context of what you just raised, that, you know, this isn't like the government going and requesting a retraction or requesting, you know, a modification or a correction. You know, this is about going to a platform and asking them to censor, and compelling, I think it's not just trying to persuade, but compelling them to censor an entirely different party who is completely unrelated other than has an account on their platform. It's not even like there's an employee-employee relationship or this is the whole newspaper. And Alito even made that comment that in no way would this application, in the same way that the Biden administration is trying to defend, in no way would this apply to print media. And I thought that was an interesting question as well.
I think so. I mean, listen, I am confident that the opinion is going to be better than the oral argument, but the oral argument did leave a lot to be desired. And Justice Roberts, who I've defended in our most recent discussion, did not cover himself with glory.
Well, I mean, and this is, you know, they always say that on on media, you're only as good as your last media hit. I think that's also true for justices. You're only as good as your last oral argument or your last opinion, because Roberts is interesting. I mean, he kind of goes back and forth sometimes, and he's gotten things so right and spot on. I mean, his dissent in the Obergefell case back in 2015 was one of the best, in my view. He articulated it so well. And then he's had other things that I'm like, what are you thinking? And it doesn't seem to jive in a cohesive worldview of the Constitution. But this is why this is all so fascinating, and not just from a philosophical standpoint, but from a practical application, because this case matters, and it matters to the outcome of how we are able as citizens to exercise our liberties and our freedom and our constitutionally protected rights in a public forum that is online social media. So the case is Murthy versus Missouri. And Ron Coleman, my fantastic guest today, always appreciate your insights. You can follow him on X, on social media, until, you know, maybe he gets banned one of these days for, you know, some kind of some kind of speech that the government doesn't like. I'm just waiting for that day. I've been censored on social media before, but thanks to Elon. Anyway, we'll be right back with more right after this. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. When Charlotte found out she was pregnant, she was 7 weeks along. In the back of her mind, she thought abortion was the best solution. But after hearing her baby's heartbeat and seeing her beautiful baby on an ultrasound, she chose life. Her heart is filled with gratitude for all of you who made this possible. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are ranting this morning about free speech, about the First Amendment, the U.S. Constitution more broadly, some of the total misconceptions of some of our sitting Supreme Court justices who really need to go back to Con Law 101. But this just goes into a much larger rant that I have actually been ranting about since I went to law school, which is that law school does not teach constitutional law well, does not tell our future advocates and future justices of the Supreme Court how to understand the Constitution in context, rather than just understand what the Supreme Court has said about the Constitution in its jurisprudence since Marbury versus Madison, which was the first case from the Supreme Court that established the concept of judicial review, which is the idea that and the premise that the court can review challenges and make binding opinions. And this has been a long debate between legal scholars to say, you know, did Marbury initially go beyond Article 3 and what the Supreme Court's power was actually given to it, a limited power in Article 3 in the U.S. Constitution? Did it go beyond that? I think it did. And I think that there have been a number of originalist justices and very good lawyers that have questioned the premise of judicial review from all the way back in 1803 when that first case was founded. I mean, and look, that was at the very beginning of our country, right? I mean, that's the first that's the first sitting Supreme Court that already tried to take too much power, and that was the whole point of why our framers separated powers on the federal level, limited powers to government, because they knew. And Madison said in Federalist 51 that men are designed to want to grab more power, and until men are angels, then, you know, government is going to be necessary. But how do you give government enough power to act legitimately, but also not enough power so that you can properly restrain it? And that has been the tension of all governments across human history. And this is why we look forward to a government ultimately that is governed by our King himself, King Jesus, because he will be the perfect governor and have the perfect form of government in eternity and in a new heaven and new earth. But we have shades of legitimacy here when we understand how God has given human beings limited power under his created order, his created authority, and his institutions and his designs, which are the civil government, the church government, and the family government. And when we look at God's design, and we have to see all of this as pre-political and understand how God created first and what the reality of the universe to which we are presented is, and then we can start asking and answering the questions about legitimacy in government. And these are the questions that nobody in law schools, other than, you know, maybe a couple of Christian law schools, like Regent, Liberty, a few, but even in a great law school like I went to, I mean, I went to Richmond Law. I loved it. I had some professors who were Christians, but in my own constitutional law class, none of this was discussed. Worldviews and philosophy was really not discussed. You start constitutional law class in law school saying, okay, what did Marbury versus Madison hold? Well, the concept of judicial review. And we just take that for granted. We take that as, well, obviously that's correct. Just like the court yesterday. Well, obviously the government has a legitimate role and has a duty, in fact, according to Ketanji Brown Jackson, to combat misinformation and social harm where it sees, right? So we're making these basic assumptions and these premises that are actually faulty. And it's incumbent upon the Christian to go back and to say, well, wait a minute, why are we accepting these premises? Because anybody who has ever done any kind of formal debate understands that if you have basic assumptions implicit in your debate that are against you, then you could be conceding the entire debate before you even say a word. And that's what the left has done so very well, what the Supreme Court has done actually so very well when it has gotten so far off track of the limited powers of government, and how we've gotten to the point that it's so difficult to even argue our conclusions, because we have to go back first and call out the basic assumptions as faulty and as wrongly articulated in their origination. And this is why when I went through law school and I questioned these things, and I hated constitutional law class, and the left has now made fun of me for saying that publicly and going, you know, well, you know, you have represented clients, you know, most famously President Trump, you know, in some of these cases that deal with constitutional law, and, you know, and yet they're totally, again, misunderstanding what I'm saying. I was saying that I hated constitutional law class, and it was actually my worst grade initially in law school, because the way it was taught was designed on a faulty premise. And so I set out to change that. And my entire ministry and where God has now led me to this very platform that I'm speaking on right now has been because an apologetic of the law is necessary for the Christian, for the conservative, to be able to argue our political theory, our policy theory. We have to first understand an apologetic and a worldview of constitutional law that is correct. And this is why we now have this clip from Justice Thomas. This is why this question was so brilliant yesterday. Play this clip.
You continue to refer to government speech. For my edification, what's the constitutional basis for government speech?
Yeah, so the court has said, I think, that the government is entitled to speak for itself. It's not a right that comes from the First Amendment. It's a feature of our constitutional democracy. As the court has said, the government couldn't function if it couldn't express points of view. In Walker, the court explained, for example, that the government has to be able to run a vaccination campaign at times of public health crisis. I think that's a major part of what was going on here. So the court hasn't located it in any specific constitutional provision. It's just part of democratic governance.
So I was literally applauding yesterday in my car as I was listening to this, going, yay, Justice Thomas, for that zinger and for the concession by Solicitor General Fletcher that there's no specific constitutional provision. But notice how he said this is not a right from the First Amendment. And that's where he gets it totally wrong. Even though he concedes that there is no specific provision where a right for government to speak is found in the text, notice how lawyers always frame the First Amendment as granting us rights. This is one of the most common misconceptions about the U.S. Constitution and why we have to go back to challenging these basic assumptions, because the U.S. Constitution does not grant rights to individuals. This myth is perpetuated by leftists mainly, but even by some of us who fail to understand the Constitution in context, and by activist judges like Ketanji Brown Jackson, who would proceed from the premise that if government through the Constitution grants rights, then the government can take them away. Right. And this is the entire crux of this case yesterday. This is what the Bill of Rights expressly forbids. There is a difference between rights versus privileges. Rights, as our founders recognized in the Declaration of Independence, are those unalienable aspects of our humanity that set us apart from all other beings. These are rights that can't be sold, bought, abridged, or otherwise infringed at the government's whim, including life and liberty and a lot of other rights. These are the rights that are pre-political. It doesn't matter what system of government or even country we are in. It doesn't matter if you're currently in communist China. You have rights that are given by your creator because God created everything and everyone. So these are rights that cannot be sold, bought, abridged, or otherwise infringed just at the government's whim. And the Declaration specifically acknowledges that our rights are endowed by our Creator, not our government. So the founders who wrote this Declaration, and all of whom were lawyers, they were substantively versed in philosophy of jurisprudence, legitimacy in government. They went on to say in the Declaration that the only proper role of civil government is to preserve and protect these unalienable rights. And the American experiment was born to implement a system that was best designed with this kind of novel but truthful recognition of rights pre-existing government. This is truth with a capital T. This is not my truth versus your truth or the ministry of who is the arbiter of truthiness, as Ben Shapiro would say. This is truth that God created and our rights pre-exist government. And so privileges, on the other hand, are a special kind of advantage or entitlement or protection typically granted to an individual person or a group of people. And privileges are advantages given to citizens by their government. So in the context of the Constitution, we the people of the United States, this is the group that is granted privileges by our government. And those privileges should operate consistent with the constitutional rationale to form a more perfect union, provide for the common defense, and all of those other valid purposes that are listed in the preamble. But these privileges could change, unlike unalienable rights. Privileges could be given or taken away, and you have to fulfill the metric of what privileges, you have to qualify, is the word I'm looking for. You have to qualify for privileges. Like for example, the privilege of jury duty. You have to be 18. You have to live in a specific jurisdiction, among other things. And even if you are stricken for cause, you may not be, even if you meet all of those basic qualifications, you may be stricken for other legal purposes. It's not a right to sit on a specific jury or to sit on a jury at all. But the right to speak freely without government intrusion and infringement is a pre-political right. It is a part of our humanity. The right to parent, the right to family, the right to free exercise of our religion. All of these things that the Bill of Rights specifically says, Congress, just in case you were not clear that you only have specific limited powers that are listed in Article 1, Section 8, we are going to tell you some very, very specific things that you cannot do, that you cannot infringe upon. And one of those things is freedom of speech. And so we need to reject the basic assumption that Solicitor General Fletcher posed to the court in his comments by saying there's not a First Amendment right. No, I'm sorry. This is a constitutionally protected pre-political right. This is a right given by God, my creator. This is an unalienable right that the First Amendment is designed to preserve and protect, because even without the First Amendment, God still gives me all of my rights, and it's still unalienable, even if the First Amendment didn't exist. That is not taught in law schools, and it needs to. And I would highly commend to your reading, if I may be so bold, the book that I wrote on this, because this infuriated me going through law school to see how this is taught. It's called The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution. You can get that. You can read it substantively. This is my whole argument, and this is where my ministry first started. You can always reach me and my team, jenna@afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.